Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and today we will talk about the initiative of the European political community. I'm happy to host for this conversation Gian Pisani Ferri, Senior Fellow and former Director of Bruegel, Daniela Schwarzer, Executive Director of the Open Society Europe and Central Asia, and Shaheen Vallee, Head of the Geoeconomics Programme of the German Council of Foreign Relations. Jean, Shaheen, Daniela, welcome to The Sound of Economics.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having me.
Great. So this episode is produced in cooperation with the Open Society and the German Council on Foreign Relations and live recorded on Twitter Spaces. And I'm particularly happy to host you today for two reasons. One is that you have co-authored an excellent paper on the topic of the European political community, and the link will be in the show notes. And secondly, because on 6 October 2022, the first meeting of this new configuration called the European political community will take place. Therefore, it is particularly timely for our listeners, as even if very much linked to the current crisis, it might have been a topic caught off the radar amidst the current turbulent reporting of the policy agenda from Brussels and beyond. So maybe a little backgrounder before we start our conversation. The European political community is a new political grouping proposed by the French President Emmanuel Macron that would include the EU countries, the Balkans, and other nearby states, including the United Kingdom. In his role as the President of the Council of the European Union, Macron officially presented the project at the meeting of the European Council on the 23rd of June 2022. And it was endorsed in the State of the Union speech by the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, in September. And as mentioned, it would materialize in the form of a EU Plus summit on 6-7 October in Prague. And we can also mention the fact that a few days ago, on the 29th of September, the UK announced that it would attend the meeting and even offered to host the next meeting. So the aim of this project is to provide a policy coordination platform for European countries across the continent and foster political dialogue and cooperation in order to address issues of common interest, so as to strengthen the security, stability, and prosperity of the European continent. The idea resonates with the proposal of a European Confederation put forward by François Mitterrand in 1989, to which the French president referred to. The proposal entails establishing a European political space beyond the European Union. But so far, beside this very initial sketching, very little is known about the shape and the potential of the initiative. Daniela, Jean and Shaheen, you have delved into the proposal, and it will be interesting to kick off the conversation to take a step back and provide our listeners with a bit of background. Can some of you start by recalling how did we arrive to the proposal and which needs it should address?
I'm happy to do that if you want me to. So I think what we need to look at really is not only what happened since Emmanuel Macron first put forward this idea, but rather how the European Union has been dealing with its neighborhood over the past years. So there were essentially two approaches. One has traditionally been offering accession perspectives and going into enlargement negotiations as a way to bring countries closer to the EU and eventually into the EU. And the other has been European neighborhood policy facing east, but also facing south. And if we go back a number of years, there was still hope that, for instance, the Eastern Neighborhood Policy, which started out with, as Eastern Partnership, six countries, and then split very quickly into 3+3, where three were seen as front runners: Ukraine, the Republic of Moldova, and Georgia. There was hope that they would transform, that they would really build closer ties with the European Union, while the other three were not seen as in the leading group, and there was doubt whether those tools would actually effectively bring more stable relationships and eventually also some opening of the countries politically and economically. So the Eastern Partnership, which was considered not to be putting the EU into geopolitical opposition to Russia, at some point was seen as doing just that and really pushed by Russia, which developed that narrative that there is this kind of competition for that space between Russia and the European Union. And this is why, actually, for years, we have seen how delicate the situation was getting. And now with Russia's war on Ukraine, I believe there is a very broad recognition in the European Union and in European capitals that the traditional policies towards our neighbors are not enough and something new needs to happen. And so I would say it's probably the most clear initiative that answers the point that there is really a new geopolitical era that has begun. It didn't begin on February 24th with the beginning of the war. It began de facto way before that. But now there is this political recognition. And the countries that I have just mentioned have all said to actually already applied for membership, Ukraine and the Republic of Moldova. So we are in a new phase, but we cannot bet on accession negotiations to bring the kind of stability and closeness of ties. We see it also in the Western Balkans, where something in addition to the negotiations and the pre-enlargement policies, it would be very useful. So just in two or three points, what that could be, it could be a forum where those geopolitical challenges are openly discussed, but where also a minimum of geopolitical alignment can actually be assured. Meaning, for instance, sanction policy on Russia is agreed upon by the countries. Another thing would be to define very concrete policy initiatives that can actually bring the country step by step closer to working with the European Union, working among each other. So also the regional initiatives that exist, like the Open Balkans, can be productively used to really do everything possible to enhance the relationships between countries that at some point really all agree that they are part of the Europe based on the norms of the European Union and the Council of Europe. So if the forum can deliver both a space for geopolitical debate and concrete policies to be extended to countries that may not be part of it, and brings them together on eyes level, so not to have only bilateral relationships between the country and the EU, really all countries meet on eyes level, they talk to each other, the EU should be part of it as well. I think that would be an achievement which is the beginning of an answer to the geopolitical challenges our continent is facing.
Thank you, Daniela, for this first overview. And surely we are going to get back to some of your points, especially when it comes to the enlargement policy and the neighborhood policy and how it plays all around. But maybe coming back to the backgrounder and asking Shaheen or John about the other elements that constitute somehow an important part of the reflection of why we arrived at that stage, before going afterwards on what is actually going to be this EPC.
So, you know, I think the background on top of the issues that that Daniela has mentioned is a domestic internal EU background, whereby institutional reforms inside the European Union have been blocked, even though there is a broad realization that there needs to be EU institutional reforms. Macron had launched a number of initiatives during his first term, whether it be the Convention démocratique or, more recently, the Conference on the Future of the EU. All have somewhat failed to deliver an agenda for EU institutional reforms, for democratization, and for treaty reforms. And so I think the reason why we're coming to a point where the EPC is on the table is because the vehicles for discussing internal EU reforms have been missing for quite a while, and the few vehicles that were attempted have failed. And I think we're coming to a very important meeting of the minds between France and Germany. And I think the speech by Chancellor Scholz in Prague in September was very important in that sense, because I think, to my recollection at least, it was the first time that we had a German chancellor saying, yes, the EU will enlarge. It will probably enlarge to at least 36 member states, but it cannot enlarge with these institutions and with these treaties. Meaning, basically, that EU institutional reforms need to precede the next wave of EU accession. And I think, you know, this is the second part of the context that is important to have in mind, you know, the external and geopolitical dimension that Daniela has mentioned, but the internal dimension to us is equally important.
So the debate of widening versus deepening the European Union, if I would echo what you are saying, Shaheen, right?
Yeah, exactly. So in our view, the EPC could be, we're not saying it will be, you know, our proposal was very normative in that sense, could be a vehicle to address both the enlargement challenge as well as the deepening challenge, which we both considered, for different reasons, were somewhat stuck for the past few years.
But if I may be the devil's advocate here, as moderate this discussion, we've seen in the case of many other political initiatives involving non-EU member states with a lot of good intentions, but followed then by very little action on the ground. For example, the Union for the Mediterranean was one of those in the mid of 2000s, for example, that were also championed by the French. How would you like to see the EPC taking concrete shape during the weeks and the months after the summit? So really, what this new configuration should address concretely? Perhaps Jean can shed some light on your ideas on that.
Yes, I think the big difference between the initiatives of the past and this possible initiative is the urgency. I mean, the situation with the war in Ukraine has changed the cards entirely. The EU made a bold move of granting candidate status to Ukraine and Moldova, but the question now, and it's an urgent question, is what comes next? If we keep them, in the negotiation process for accession for a very long time, until first they satisfy the conditions for membership, and second that the EU itself has reformed, has agreed on internal reforms so that the enlargement can take place, there is a very high risk of disappointment with all the political consequences you can imagine. Or there is a risk that there will be an enormous U.S. pressure to enlarge and therefore to sort of take in new member states, certainly those two, but also member states in the Balkans, because they have been waiting for a long time without having first done the institutional reform that are required. So basically, we are facing a conundrum. And our view is that the EPC could be, in the short term, could be really be a bridge towards membership. It's not an alternative to membership. It's a bridge to membership. It could, start with immediate, urgent cooperation on energy, on security, perhaps on other fields. It could also help, foster integration, prepare the accession process. And in the medium term, it could end up being for those countries that have decided not to join because they just, took the opposite decision, like the UK, or because there are a number of conditions that are not going to be met, like for Turkey, etc. it could turn into a sort of permanent structure at some point. So we see the EPC as two things at the same time. First, a sort of cooperation based on soft law, a response to an urgent problem. And second, in the longer term, let's say post-2030, a sort of permanent structure having decided what belongs to the EU and what is part of a wider circle of cooperation. And that's why I think it's a very positive that the UK is actually attending the Prague summit.
And indeed, on this issue of the UK, Jean, if I may, so one aspect that really strikes is it has been the reluctance and then the agreement of the UK to join, and then even the proposal to host the next meeting. And you in the aftermath of Brexit, you wrote together with other Bruegel colleagues about the need for a continental partnership. It was mentioned before. At the time, this was considered somehow a wild idea. Is the EPC somehow and somewhat close to that proposal that you had in mind back then?
In some respects, yes. In some other, not. The question of security and defense that's so prominent these days, and for which the UK is such an important player, was not prominent at that time. Also, we regarded the what we call the Continental Partnership as a sort of wider circle around the EU. Not exactly as in this case, a partnership among equals in which all countries should have a voice. So there are a number of differences. Eventually it could evolve into something that has relationship to this earlier idea, but the imminent urgent matters. Again, energy and security give a substance to this project of EPC that actually did not exist at the time. At the time, it was all about finding a way to sort of create a partnership, not to dissolve all the links with the UK. Actually, the idea was not well received in the EU. Didn't go anywhere.
So we hope that this time is going to be different.
We do.
Giuseppe, if I may go back to your question about and the parallel you drew between the EPC and the failed experience of the Union pour la Méditerranée, because I think this is an excellent question. And I think Jean stressed the importance of urgency as a differentiating factor. But I think there are more than that. I think the Union pour la Méditerranée was missing several critical things that we're advocating for in the EPC. It was missing a strong institutional backbone. It was missing identified areas of policy cooperation. It was missing financial resources to make these areas of policy cooperation effective. And it was missing a governance that allowed, as Daniela said, member states to speak on an equal footing. Instead, the EPC, the Union pour la Méditerranée had de facto a hub and spoke structure with France being at the heart of it, even though France tried hard to hide that. And so this is why, in our view, the EPC, in order to be successful and in order not to end like the Union pour la Méditerranée, it needs to have a strong governance, which we believe should be, and this is a delicate topic because there are pros and cons to having the European Commission at the heart, but we believe the European Commission should play a leading role. We have identified in our paper specific areas of policy cooperation. There could be others, but we think it's important that the member states agree on what these areas of policy cooperation are. And we believe there needs to be then financial resources and a governance, meaning, a set of informal rules for deciding that are such that there is actual policy decisions taking place over and above just a simple political discussion between the heads of states.
Thank you, Shaheen. And I wanted to go a little bit more into the broader implications of the EPC, and perhaps go back to Daniela and discuss the broader landscape that that this initiative is included with. You've mentioned the positioning of the EU in the neighborhood and so on, but that's definitely also an initiative that is going to be crucial for the positioning of the EU in the world. How do you think it resonates with the idea of the EU as a geopolitical actor?
It is, for me, one of many policies that show that there is an increasingly realization that the geopolitical and the geoeconomic challenges to the EU are on the rise, and that the policies which I've briefly touched upon, and my colleagues as well, that the EU so far ran with regards to its neighborhood are simply not good enough. And I would say there have been several attempts over the past 1 or 2 years to self-correct and to actually be more ambitious and impactful. And one of the geopolitical challenges that is not driving this particular project, but which is out there, is of course also the rising influence of China in our neighboring countries. And so I would say there are several things happening at the same time. We see the Global Gateway Initiative going into implementation, which in part also concerns the countries we're discussing now. We see a rethinking earlier on of how the accession process can be structured and how pre-accession aid and other policies should be designed. And this is, I would say, an additional element of geopolitical realization. A second point I wish to make in responding to your question is that the EU really, I think, has realized that it will have to take more responsibility for its own neighborhood in the years to come. Right now, we are speaking at a moment where there is a war on our continent and the United States are back big time as an actor, as a partner to the EU in terms of sanctions packages, as a partner in terms of financial support to Ukraine and arms deliveries, and frankly, as the main deterrent to prevent Russia from doing, for instance, employing non-conventional arms. So the US are currently a big player, but we know that the politics in the US are at this point not foreseeable. There may be a change of attitude towards how much the United States will continue to invest in Europe and Europe's East. We have seen Trump in action. He might come back in 2 years or a candidate similar to him. And so I think Europe has to really think very hard how to not only develop policies that can actually bring our neighboring countries closer to the EU, but really that allow the EU to be more solidified on the European continent with its neighbors, and then to think beyond that.
Thank you, Daniela. I would like, speaking of the neighborhood, to invite two other guests here on stage, which I'm very happy that they could make time this afternoon to join us. One is Hilib Vyshlinsky, if I pronounce it correctly, who is the executive director of the Center for Economic Strategy in Ukraine and is connecting from Ukraine here on our Twitter space. I just invited you to join. Hilib, are you? I hope that you perfect that you are here. Hi. And Milica, one second. Milica Delevic from the EBRD. I'm trying to invite you as well as a speaker. Just one second. Also, because I think that we cannot discuss about the neighborhood without hearing some voices about how this is being perceived in the countries which are knocking at the doors of the EU, or I mean, and in the Ukraine case is obviously a very special one. So Milica, also welcome. Can we just perhaps from your perspective, a round of comments about what you just heard from Shaheen, Jean, and Daniela? It will be great to hear your point of view.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for the invitation. I think an initiative to reimagine relationships with neighbors cannot come earlier. This really, I think, was long overdue, and having something like the European Political Community, which provides a forum for dialogue at the multilateral and bilateral level among European leaders, I think is beyond doubt a good thing in this era when we have geopolitical, climate, energy, economic challenges. I think we need to think here how to fill this with content. And to be able to do so, we need to actually think what we have here. And we have representatives of most of the continent countries. And as we know, it goes well beyond the EU borders. And while President Macron mentioned that he would like to avoid the central role of EU institutions, the fact that we just can't neglect is that all of the countries invited already have contractual relationships with the EU. These are very diverse. We have candidates, applicants, more or less closely associated partners, and we have a disgruntled former member. I think this diversity actually offers the biggest opportunity for the European political community, as it allows EU to engage countries beyond the set templates that it normally relies on. But that's also a bit of a trap and a challenge, because it needs to do so without hollowing out existing processes, most importantly, enlargement, and not becoming a justification for enlargement being kicked into a very, very long grass. So I think in order for this EPC to be functional, to avoid being a mere talking shop, which I don't think would be bad, but if you expect countries to align and not to look to China or Russia, thinking about the Balkans, if you offer them a forum for discussion, that would be nice. But if pandemic repeats itself and you offer a forum for discussion and China offers vaccines, I guess that you can imagine which way things would go. So if you want to have more than a talking shop, I would think the best way to do it is to use the EPC as an incentive for opening up sectoral integration to more European countries. Obvious model is Schengen zone of passport-free travel, in which we know a number of EU non-EU countries participate and some EU countries don't. And this would allow that EU institutions are involved in areas where they have competence instead of being intergovernmentalized. And this also, if it's somehow married to variable geometry, and we've touched upon the earlier Bruegel paper of 2016, I think could be a good opportunity to bring the continent closer in a way which is both inclusive and flexible. But my key point would be that the group of countries are different, and that to ensure that this has a meaning for everybody, you need to combine substance with flexibility and dialogue with some concrete incentives.
Thank you, Milica. I would really be interested in the reactions to what you just said. I would like to give the floor first to Ilib, so to hear also his opinion, and then I'll give back the floor to our guests.
Yeah, no, thank you, Giuseppe. My first initial reaction is that we need to remember the story of EU neighborhood. Like, we are still technically the country of the EU neighborhood. However, like, I believe everybody here understands that it is already obsolete with, Belarus, one country, being, in fact, fighting with Russia in a war against Ukraine. Armenia and Azerbaijan are fighting with each other, and three other states have US, clear EU aspirations, and Ukraine and Moldova our EU candidate states already. So we need really not to reproduce this bad story. I really do not see any significant impact of the EU neighborhood initiative on Ukraine, except of some very narrow sectoral things like some integration in digital, for example, and practically maybe that's all, maybe something I don't know about, but still not very obvious. So I think that, for the first is that, as Melissa said, that it should not be a vehicle to prolong the process of proper accession for candidate countries like Ukraine. And I believe that maybe the story of Russian war against Ukraine and the story of EU reaction and the G7 reaction and generally democratic world election to this war that was rather fast and some things were done very fast for the first time should be a reason for the EU and for EU intellectuals like those who are on this discussion to think how this process of the EU reform should be sped up and not to to use, as Melissa proposed, this initiative as a vehicle to integrate European countries as countries that belong to the European continent, including United States, Switzerland, Norway, countries that are still not member but are candidate countries, all have EU aspirations in projects that are dependent, in fact, on the geography of Europe, including Turkey as well, transport, migration, Schengen zone was mentioned as one of examples when you need integration because everybody is neighboring each other. But it doesn't mean that it should be something that should be that will be the sort of the parallel process of sectoral negotiations that should be done with candidate states. And when we speak about I am not really a very big expert in political side of EU reform and European integration generally, but the story of the last 7 months has clearly shown that veto power is very easy to be misused. And the story of Hungary currently is very clear. So I think that it should be another reason for this process of the EU reform to be sped up so that it will be much easier to the current EU members to accommodate new member states, including Western Balkans and Ukraine and Moldova into the Union.
Thank you, Hilib. And we have quite a lot of food for thought. So Daniela, John and Chahin, it would be great if you could react to what we just heard.
I can react quickly, if you wish. I think that's very important what we heard. And let me try to answer, in concrete terms. I mean, we agree that the neighborhood policy has been a failure. We think that the EPC should be different in several aspects. First, it should be based on values and geopolitical alignment. So it's not easy to define what it means. We know that there are differences, but what we're proposing is, rather than to have a preset list of criteria that would be applied at the entry, we propose that there is and there will be actually among the participants, there will be a high degree of convergence. And the question then is to give to a group of countries, some of which are part of the EU, some of which are not part of the EU, the role of defining how to apply those principles and how to assess geopolitical alignment as well as respect for the rule of law. So we'd rather see countries self-select out rather than having them assessed by a sort of, you know, tribunal that would check at the entrance. Second, and this is very much linked, we see the European political community as much more multilateral than the EU neighborhood or the which was dominated by the EU, with partner which hardly had a voice, or applicant countries that hardly had a voice and had essentially to show that they were fit for membership. So we see here something that's more multilateral, in which, you know, for example, I think we have to learn from the Ukraine on a number of things. They are on the front line. They have demonstrated a high degree of sophistication and an ability to respond. And I think in terms of security, we have to learn from the Ukraine, and this should be recognized from the start. The third aspect is that, and that connects to what you both said, it has to be concrete. You know, you wouldn't want to start from a long list of potential common initiatives. I think the energy and security and defense emerge very strongly as fields where there should be a common aspect in the EPC. Now, that doesn't exclude having other aspects. We know, we're mentioning in passing research, there could be other fields, but you wouldn't want to overload the EPC with a long list of potential policies. Let's be experimental. And I think that this experimental character is really also what characterizes our proposal in terms of how to proceed. We want to be experimental as regards the field of cooperation. We want to be experimental as regards the way of cooperating and the way of deciding. Clearly, we're not going to solve ex ante the question of how to weigh the different countries and how to reform the voting system. What I think should be done, clearly those things have to be done and they're part of the reform of the EU. So a relatively long, as we know by experience process of negotiating the reform of voting rights, etc. But at the same time, the EPC should start from the start, from the beginning, with, you know, decision methods that are experimental and that check what can be done without the curse of unanimity. So what we are proposing is to be based on soft law, to agree on some principle, and to agree on a rule that is to decide by rough consensus, which means, you know, there needs to be something sufficiently close to a unanimity without excluding the possibility that some voices are dissenting and that, you know, they accept to be put in a minority. So this is very experimental, this is very soft law, but I think that we think that's how it should be.
Thank you, Jean. Daniela or Shahin, would you like to react as well to what we heard from Milica and Hilip?
Okay, so no, I think I was pleased to hear in the reaction that both, you know, agreed to the link between the internal reform agenda and the enlargement issue, which is not obvious and which many people in Eastern Europe are afraid could be a ploy to delay accession and kick it into the long grass. So I'm pleased to hear that the conclusion is that EU institutional reform needs to accelerate, because there was also for quite a while, and I think there is still, the perception that another way of addressing the current enlargement challenge would be just to accelerate enlargement irrespective of EU institutional reforms. And I think that would be a mistake. And I think what we are experiencing today in the way the EU operates and its institutional shortcomings speaks to the fact that an EU of 36 member states, each endowed with veto powers in critical areas of policy cooperation, would actually be a weaker European Union that is less able to project power geopolitically. And so there seems to be an emerging consensus around this, which I think was not obvious just a few months ago. So I'm quite pleased by that, and if I understood correctly the remarks by the two other speakers.
Thank you. Daniela?
Yes, just maybe three short points. One is the need for flexibility, and Jean has really outlined that. And you know, it's this, the way we suggest to build the EPC, it is experimental, because our assessment really is that the EU is stuck on two accounts. One is the institutional reform progress, which is not happening, and the other one is enlargement. And as we have said, and the two speakers currently outside of the EU have observed, this is necessary progress that needs to be made, because what we do not want is to stall enlargement. And so this connection, which we see as a possibility in the project, is as much, you know, concerning to governments, because they never like anything experimental. And yet it is an opportunity. What I think in my view shouldn't happen is that the EU institutions are weakened by all of that. I think it's important to recognize that it's not about dissolving the European Union, but the core of the EU 27 and enlarged in the future. It has to change, but it also needs to hold, because it is an anchor of stability on our continent. And then the question of self-selection and the question of the normative base that was raised. Jean already spoke to it. I just want to add that, of course, this is probably the most conflictual issue, and there might be a real political appetite to just avoid it, because the meeting on Thursday will be very big. And, you know, there could be a temptation to say, well, we will just meet in that same group again because it was interesting and it worked well. But I think that the deeper then the policy discussion will go, or the deeper the geopolitical conflict may go in the next few weeks and months, the more then this forum will be undermined by the lack of normative consensus and geopolitical alignment if it isn't ensured. So I would say this should be approached as a topic as early as possible, meaning at the first meeting. And we have set out our proposals, what normative base that exists with the EU and with the Council of Europe should be used, plus the alignment on policies towards Russia. And for some countries, it may actually, you know, be a difficult decision how to position themselves, but at least it is a decision. And if the decision is not taken now to align, it can be taken later. And that's the way we really thought about it all along, that it is an open group, but it needs to be solid in terms of knowing what the identity of that group is. So I just wanted to add those points.
So thank you, Daniela. We are going towards the end of our episode, but if I may summarize what you all just said. So a lot of potential, but it's extremely important to keep the alignment about what are the goals, and then keep some sort of experimental nature of all this, and your proposal to use soft law, at least for the beginning, in order to develop this, seems to be the way to go forward in order to be able this experiment to move forward, if I understand correctly. And then thirdly, and not least important, the fact that it should be an accelerator for enlargement and not seen as a substitute for enlargement. That seems some of the messages that you are sketching out from this conversation and the paper. But correct me if I'm wrong or if I'm forgetting something major over there.
I think I would just add one thing, which I think is the distinction between the degree of institutionalization and the degree of informality. And here I think you have a number of member states who would rather have a very informal political discussion amongst heads of states with limited institutionalization. And basically the model would be for a sort of continental G20. The model we're advocating for is a bit more institutionalized than this, in the sense that it's aiming to deliver genuine policy cooperation, and as a result requires a degree of institutionalization. And so I think heads of states will have to decide which way they want to go. It might be that they only start as just an informal political dialogue. But our view is that if this informal political dialogue doesn't turn into actual policy cooperation and a degree of institutionalization, then our fear is that, you know, the importance of that forum will decline over time, and this we think would be a disappointment.
Thank you. And on this note, we are going to close. But I would like to remind everyone that the excellent paper by Jean Daniela Chahine and also Franz Mayer, that couldn't join us for this recording, which is called Enlarging and Deepening, Giving Substance to the European Political Community, is available for reading on the show notes. So you'll find the link, and the whole proposal that is sketched over there can be seen in full details. And I would like also to remind everyone that, as usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by Bruegel scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. And last but not least, I would like to thank the Open Society and the German Council for Foreign Relations for co-organizing this excellent conversation here on Twitter Space and recorded for The Sound of Economics. So thank you to everyone, and of course thank you for our listeners, both the ones that have tuned in during the recording as well as the ones that will listen to us in our usual channels for The Sound of Economics. And thank you, Hilib and Milica, to join, and Jean, Daniela and Shaheen once more. Until next time, bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everyone.